Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Judith King makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce her briefly. She was here some years ago, but Judith King is Associate Professor of History and Associate Dean of Postgraduate Research at the Faculty of Arts at the University of Sydney. She teaches and writes on 20th century cultural and political history and on European film history. She is the author of Fighting for Franco, International Volunteers and the Nationalist Spain during the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. And it was on that topic that Professor King spoke for us some years ago when her book came out. And now she's back at the Sydney Institute with the publication of another book, Treason on the Airwaves, Three Allied Broadcasters on Axis Radio during World War II, which has just been released by CUP. But the topic for Dr. King's talk tonight at the Sydney Institute is Treason and the Trial of Traitors in 20th Century Australia. Judith King, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard, for inviting me. I'm incredibly happy to come back. I must say, I had fun. It doesn't sound quite right, but I actually had some fun last time I came to you. You all look rather stunned, is that possible? Fun. I'm going to talk tonight about three traitors who are the subject of my book that came out at the end of last year. But I want particularly to talk about the Australian. The three traitors are, it sounds a bit like a joke, a British civilian, John Avery, who was tried as a traitor at the end of the Second World War and executed in Britain, an Australian, Charles Cousins, who many of you may have heard of, who had been a very distinguished, very well-known radio broadcaster on 2GB before the war, and who, after the war, had a treason trial, was tried as a traitor, in fact, in the Central Court here in Sydney. And the third one is somebody whom you may well know of, or I certainly did before I began this book, though what I knew about her was all I discovered was total misinformation. And that was about Eva Taguri, who perhaps is better known by her sobriquet, Tokyo Rose. And I know as a child I had heard about Tokyo Rose. I remember my father explaining to me about this horrendous woman because I had an uncle who was on the Burma Railway. And he explained that this woman, Tokyo Rose, used to come on the radio at night and that my grandmother would sit glued to the set hoping to find out some word of her son, my father's brother, who was on the Burma Railway, and that this terrible woman would taunt Australian soldiers in the Pacific War. And I remember thinking this was so hideous as a young, this little girl living in country Australia, I said New South Wales, I couldn't even imagine that anybody could do anything so grotesque, especially to our lovely Uncle Keith, who we knew had been away fighting, or before I was born, he had been away fighting. So she was somebody, I began the project, I felt I knew quite a bit about her, though as my research unfolded, it turned out that what I thought I knew about her, in fact, was wrong. So what I want to do tonight is to talk very briefly about these three, because they are it's like a triptych in dealing with the question of treason and dissidents in wartime. I have these three examples who do very similar things, in that each of them broadcast on Axis Radio, and Avery from Berlin, and Cousins and Eva Taguri from Tokyo, and were tried at the end of the war and then had these very different outcomes. But it's Charles Cousins that I want to speak to you most about, because he's a Sydney-sider, as we are, and so it's sort of interesting to know his story too, particularly. But just to fill you in on the two that who are part of this triptych, but that we will talk mostly about Charles Cousins. So to start with John Amory. John Amory was an English civilian. He was the son of Leo Amory, who was a very senior cabinet minister in Churchill's cabinet during the war. In fact, Leo had been the secretary for the colonies and also the secretary for various times the secretary for India. And John was part of a coterie of proto-fascists. It's the same people that we were talking about when I came here last time. He was part of a coterie of proto-fascists who circled around General Franco's headquarters in the Spanish Civil War. And indeed, that's where I met John Amory, in the archive, of course, not exactly in the flesh, because I kept coming across this name in both the Spanish and the British archives. And I kept thinking, what is this chap doing? This British man, the son of Leo Amory, who's so incredibly well known, brother of Julian Amory, the youngest member of the Conservative Party ever to be elected to the Parliament. And here is this character really hanging out with French fascists. These were the people that he was with. So I began, he was the beginning of this sort of track in a way. When World War II was declared and then France fell, as we all know, Amory hooked up again because he was in the South, he'd been with General with the Nationalists in Spain, hanging not Franco's friend, but certainly hanging out with a very disreputable crowd that appear in wartime, that circle, hoping to pick up a bit of nefarious business, do a bit of currency trading, maybe a bit of arms dealing, etc. When France fell, he moved into southern France and was part of a very disreputable crowd of Italians and French fascists and some Spanish fascists who sort of dealt across the border into occupied France. And it was here that he hooked up with these people who were really essentially that he knew, I guess, and was invited to go to Berlin and join up with Goebbels in Goebbels' radio show. Remember, Goebbels and, in fact, all countries between the wars had this enormous belief in the power of radio propaganda, the so-called winning the thought wars, as the Japanese called it. So all governments had shortwave radio programs that they were beaming out to put their point of view. And Goebbels had a particular, that one of the largest and certainly one of the earliest that was established, and it had the largest number of people. So Amory went to Berlin and hooked up with these people. And you can imagine the appalling humiliation for his parents. As a parent with children who at various times of their life have been rather wild, I must say I always felt incredibly sad for the Amory parents, particularly for his mother, because they would wait. Leo's diaries are there in Cambridge in the archives. They would wait for this dreadful time on a Sunday night when John would broadcast from Berlin and they would have to listen. And I must say most of their friends were very kind and very supportive of them. But he would say things, always referred to Churchill as that Jew lover, Churchill. And even worse, even more humiliating, was that he would describe King George as a stuttering half-wit. And so for the family, this was really, really a terrible business. During the war, he sort of circulated around Europe, around occupied Europe, speaking in favour of Nazism, the so-called New Europe that he said would soon come under Nazi auspices and transform the world. The German Nazi Party, of course, and the Foreign Office were delighted to have captured this big fish because he was the son, even though he was a fairly disreputable character, he was the son of one of Churchill's cabinet ministers. So he had this massive expense account as he travelled around Europe. At the end of the war, he had, of course, been put on the wanted list of renegades, the British and the Australians, and I'm presuming the other side did the same thing. Of people who would be picked up as presumed to be traitors and tried at the end of the war. And in fact, he was caught going north with in that kind of cavalcade of really Mussolini's court, who left Milan when the armistice was, when the Germans surrendered. remember, they what was then with a great cavalcade of people drove north attempting to get into Switzerland, and Amory was with them, and the Italian resistance knew who he was, picked him up, and eventually he was brought back to Britain and tried. And in fact, he didn't go through a treason trial, but he pleaded guilty. And as I argue in the book, having documented all of this, really it seems to me it was done in order to save his family the terrible embarrassment of having their son at the end of 1945 being tried in Britain. So he pleaded guilty and he was executed. So he's one. The other end of the triptych is Eva Chagoury, and I'll say just a few words about her too. And in that, Shanshiv is, of course, the so-called Tokyo Rose, whom I'm sure many of you know of her, know that name anyway. And she's in a very interesting case, I think. She was a young Japanese-American girl, a new graduate in biology from the university, from UCLA, who's very keen on science. And she really had gone to do a gap year in Japan when just before the war was declared. And this, I discovered, it may still be for all I know, but certainly before the war, this was a very common convention among Japanese-American families that they would send their children, very often the oldest child or a couple of the oldest children, back to Japan to learn the language, to meet the relatives and learn some Japanese culture. And this is what Eva Chagoury had done. But she was there for a couple of months, and then, of course, Pearl Harbor happened. And immediately that happened, the Americans declared war, and all contact was cut off, so she couldn't get back to the US, and nor could she contact the US. And, in fact, her parents were rounded up as Japanese-Americans, even though the children certainly had American passports, and were interned during the war. And, indeed, her mother died in a camp in Idaho, but she thought didn't see them. Until long after the war was over. She was in Tokyo, stranded. She had very poor Japanese. Japanese is very difficult to learn, and she had been a real young Yankee Doodle girl, as she always called herself, because her birthday was on America's National Day. She found work as a typist, and she had obviously had very good English, and she had a university degree, and I think she had shorthand, but I'm not entirely sure about that. She found work as a typist at the radio and broadcast house in Tokyo, which was run by the Japanese Broadcasting Commission in the shortwave section. And the Japanese military had put, and it was the military, sank huge amounts of money at the beginning of the war into expanding their shortwave radio programs, because they believed, and accepting this from particularly from Germany, but in fact all between the wars, most countries believed this, that they, as the Japanese said, if we can win the thought wars, we can win the military wars too. So that these things were seen as complementary. She got a job as a typist there. She says she had a very difficult time when she was in Tokyo because she never resiled from being American, and she always says that she, felt very powerfully that she was an American girl. She always wore her saddle-stitch shoes, and she had a sort of American cold wave hairdo and all of these sorts of things.
It sounds wrong.
Oh, sorry, I can probably do it without the sound if it comes to that. So she, Princess Tokyo Rose, has a job as a type. Ooh, la la.
It's going.
Okay, can we just start again?
Sure. From the beginning?
Has the sound gone off?
The sound hasn't gone off.
It hasn't gone off.
Robin,
has the sound gone off?
No,
it's not. Okay, so the sound hasn't gone off.
I
can talk to
200 first-year European studies people.
It may have to be cut for APEC television here, so okay. Let's just start at that point
okay.
There. Now, the sound hasn't gone off, okay?
Right. So, we have Tokyo Rose working as a typist in this shortwave section of the English shortwave section of the Japanese Broadcasting Commission. And it is there that she meets Charles Cousins, and I will tell you his story too, which dovetails with this. But he met her, she was very, very kind to him and the other two POWs, two Americans who were brought first to Tokyo to set up a POW radio program. And she had, Charles Cousins said, a very deep, mannish voice, a very unusual voice. And he also says, and he gave evidence at her trial, in her defence, that she had this amazing American way, Californian way of speaking, lots of, using lots of argo and Californian slang, and she just sounded like the all-Californian girl. And so he invited her, and in fact he trained her to become a disc jockey on this program that was set up called Zero Hour. So without, we'll come back and talk about Charles Cousins in a moment. At the, so she did this, she provided the disc jockey in the patter that went with this program that was beamed back into the Pacific. It was aimed in English at Australian and American and Allied soldiers in the Pacific, and particularly at the home front, at the families in Australia, New Zealand, and on the west coast of the USA. And the hook that was used to get the families listening, and this in fact is the one that my grandmother used to listen to, hoping to hear news of her son Keith, was that from time to time they would read messages from the POWs. Now, some of these messages were clearly cooked up, invented by the Japanese, and I've tracked all of that down, but some of them were not. So, and even sometimes you would hear the voices of, occasionally they'd send out a radio crew, Japanese Broadcasting would, to get the voices actually of POWs themselves. So they created this program, but really the thing that sold it to the sailors, the soldiers and the sailors, perhaps the families at home, but particularly to the young fighting men, was that they played American music. Jazz and hot and cold jazz, the big bands, Deanna Durbin, some light classics, but it was mostly American, modern American music. And in fact, a woman at University of Minnesota about a decade ago did a study on what these old veterans could remember of this radio program, and they could all remember having listened as young men, you know, being hooked on American music. Now, she argued, and I have looked at the transcripts and looked at what happened, she argued that she was never called Tokyo Rose, that in fact Time magazine called this voice in the Pacific Tokyo Rose. There were also at least 30 other Japanese-American women who were broadcasting exactly as she was. And certainly there was one in Manila called Manila Myrtle, who used to get drunk and before she spoke and was incredibly salacious, because I've read the transcripts of some of her things. But Eva Taguri swore in court, and Cousins absolutely backed her, and as did the other people at Japanese Broadcasting, that she simply did this patter and she played the music. Well, it's at the end of the war, she was picked up and she was arrested and eventually was taken back to the USA and tried, and had quite a long treason case in San Francisco. And one would have to add that, and without, because I'm not her advocate, obviously I'm a person who reads the documents and tries to tell the story, it does seem to me significant that she was the only person who was tried in this way. That those other 30 women, who all of whose names were known, and who were, after the war, almost all of them had their American passports returned to them and simply returned to the USA and took up their previous lives. Whereas she did not. And I think there is a sort of conjunction of a whole series of things that happen. Part of it is the sort of incredible anti-Japanese sentiments that were prevalent in California at the time. I also think that the Japanese community in California actively sabotaged her trial, in that they wanted to have absolutely nothing to do with Tokyo Rose, as the Japanese American newspapers always called her, because by defending her or showing in any way supporting her, it raised all those very, very fraught questions about, well, what was it that the Japanese did to POWs during the war, and the sort of violence that had been played out on Allied prisons in Japan. So for the Japanese community, it was coming out of internment, was trying to argue that they were good American citizens as anybody else, also getting compensation, which eventually they did. To have this one figure that they said, she is Tokyo Rose and she did these bad things and she... and it is nothing to do with us. She's not like us. We are Japanese Americans, and she is another hybrid altogether. So she, in the end, she was tried as a traitor. She was convicted, and she did 10 years hard labour in women's prison in the US. In fact, her sentence was commuted. I think in the end she did 7.5 years. And indeed, Jerry Ford, in the very last day, as presidents do, they offer amnesty. Jerry Ford, in fact, gave her a complete, not amnesty, but a complete pardon, quashed her trial, and she died as a very quiet 90-year-old in Chicago about 3 or 4 years ago. So she's the other end of this triptych that I'm talking about that made the basis of the book. So then I want to talk briefly and fill up the rest of the time without running over, because Gerard will jump up and throw me off the podium if I do. But I want to then talk about Charles Cousins. And he seems to be an extremely interesting and a very poignant figure, I would have to say. Charles Cousins, as I've said, was a very distinguished broadcaster, a commercial broadcaster on 2GB, had this mellifluous voice, a rich, beautiful voice that was very well known. When the war began, he enlisted. He was in the 2nd 19th, but with the AIF. He went to Malaya. He was a captain in Malaya. He was there with the fall of Malaya and the collapse of Singapore in early 1942. And then, like all of his colleagues, all of his comrades, was put into Changi. In Changi, the Japanese identified him as somebody with radio experience. And remember, this is the time when the Japanese are attempting to expand their shortwave, desperate to build it up because it's run badly and it has plays shocking music and nobody, not even Japanese people, are interested in what is played on these wavelengths. So Cousins was picked out. He was, in fact, on his way with the first crowd, contingent to go to Burma, to the railway in Burma. And he was sent to Tokyo alone. He went by himself. And he was, when he got to Tokyo, he was by himself. He was clearly extremely distressed. He was in very poor shape. He's in poor mental shape and clearly in very poor physical shape too. And he was put in charge of creating this shortwave program, and which became Zero Hour. And after he'd been there for a month or so, two other American ex-radio men were brought too. They had been brought from Manila with the fall of the Philippines. And they too, the Japanese had identified them in the prison camp in Manila and sent them to Tokyo. And the three of them set up this program that became Zero Hour. And it was a program that was became extremely popular. It was done very professionally, and there were spin-offs from this program, Humanity Hour and the other one, which slipped my mind, but it's here. Now, clearly, and at the end of the war, as you know, Cousins was picked up. He was on the Australian list of wanted renegades. He was brought back to Sydney. Also, the only one of all of the other men. By the end of the war, there were 30 POW radio people involved with writing scripts for Zero Hour. Americans, a few Dutch, but most predominantly Americans and Australians. And he was the only one of all of those who was arrested and brought back. He was brought back under guard. Now, clearly, as a POW, Cousins had no choice. I mean, this was his argument, that as a POW, he had no volition, that if he had simply said he would not do this, that he would have been executed. So that seems to me that is inarguable. You cannot argue that, even though the court does later, the federal government that prosecutes him argues that, in fact, he enjoyed the job and that he obtained a lot of benefit from it. But he had no choice. But it also is true that he led an easier life if you like, than did other POWs in Japan. Certainly he lived in a hotel at the beginning, he wore civilian clothes, and in the first year, when the radio program was being set up, he and the two Americans were allowed to walk from the hotel to broadcast house without a guard, and that they set up this program. And it is true that other POWs faced the most horrendous thing we know of the Burma Railway, appalling things that were done. Probably, undoubtedly, even worse is the fate of the Australians who worked in the mines in northern Japan. The death rates and the cruelty is just unimaginable. Similarly, the people who worked in the shipyards, you think of those Australians working without any safety harness, being worked to death, essentially. So he doesn't have a POW experience like that. He is also, and it is true, he was a very gifted radio man, and that he had a real vocation for the radio, and that he had a passionate interest in radio. There seems to be no doubt about that. And that he's part of that small group of people who see radio as the new mass media. So he was a very effective radio man. The program that he created was Zero Hour, was done very professionally. It is also true, though he argued in his court case, that he had attempted to sort of mistrain the Japanese announcers that he was asked to train to improve their radio techniques. Though those Japanese announcers all argued that, having been exposed to some lessons by Cousins, that their radio techniques improved massively. But and I think there is a professional interest in what he was doing. And certainly Broadcast House, where he was, worked on a 24-hour rotor. They had the English-speaking ones were the biggest, and it was done largely by POWs, but there were also Arabic, Spanish, Russian, Indonesian, Italian, Chinese, etc., not done by prisoners. But so Broadcast House ran like a normal radio station that Cousins would have been aware of. And in fact, it seems to be part of the tragedy of wartime, is that these people were really professionals, that in peacetime, all of them, Japanese, Australians, POWs, etc., would have had this in common. So what do we make of this? When he was brought back, the Commonwealth raised a case against him. They had 50 transcripts of 50 talks that he had written, and he had given some broadcasts too, particularly in the early years. But later he wrote talks, and he became a trainer essentially for other announcers. Now I read these talks, and Cousins argued, obviously, one, he was under duress, and two, he said he had always attempted to send secret war information in his talks that would be useful to the Australian government. And I think there's no doubt that he genuinely believed that. But there are the problems with this became immediately apparent once in the court case, because how do you prove that the talks that you've written actually should be read in a sort of a contrary way? Some of the talks, for example, argued, as Menzies did, that Australia should be prepared for a sort of prosperous Japan after the war, and Australia should think about being part of Asia. But also, if you read that talk, you know that the Japanese had this new imperialism and talked about the co-prosperity zone. So you could read that talk and say, this is Cousins absolutely mouthing Japanese propaganda, or you could say, this is Cousins thinking about what happened after the war. In the court case, a case that was raised against him, the Commonwealth argued that he had had a good war, that he had enjoyed his job. They brought to Sydney two Japanese witnesses from the radio station who said that Cousins had never been bashed and that Cousins had made a huge contribution in training people at the radio station, and that therefore he was a traitor. Cousins' argument was, as I've said, that he was coerced, that he was sending secret information. And he had Jack Shand as his QC. He argued over and over and over that an Australian serviceman should not be found guilty on the word of a Jap, as he always kept call out in the court, get these Jacks out, you know, these two witnesses who had come. And it's true, in that era, immediately after the war, not surprisingly, there was huge antagonism to Japanese people. And the sight of these two Japanese coming and going into the court and being paid for by the Commonwealth government caused a whole lot of acrimony. Now, in the end, Cousins came to the Central Magistrates Court, and Harrington, who was the chief magistrate, decided that there was a prima facie case that he had to answer. Now, that, of course, doesn't mean that he's guilty, and it certainly doesn't mean that he's not guilty. It means simply that there is enough, that the magistrate has determined that there is enough evidence to run a case against him. And in fact, then what happened is that he was no-billed, which meant that the New South Wales Attorney General decided not to prosecute, not to go ahead with this. And many of Cousins' supporters, and there have been a couple of things written by people about this case, argued that in fact that meant that Cousins was really innocent, that the government had stepped back because they didn't have a case. But the interesting thing is that that is not the reason that he was no-billed at all. And in fact, the reason is in the legal archives in the State Record Office out here. And that was that there was simply a very strange thing to happen. There was this extraordinary conflict between the state legal people and the federal legal people, even though they were both both Labor. And indeed, the federal Attorney General had appointed Dovey, Windia, and Garfield Barwick as their counsel, and they argued over and over that there was a case to answer, and they dealt with him in the court. But the state Crown Solicitor, Mr. Weigel, I guess who I assume is the same as the Weigel Sports Ground at the bottom of Rushcutters Bay, he argued that the New South Wales government should not do the business of the federal government. Now, why that even happened was that the Australian Constitution says that to act traitorously within Australian territories and boundaries is an indictable offence. In fact, it's a capital offence. But in fact, what Cousins had done was outside Australia, which meant that he had to be tried under British treason law, because British treason law says that any assistance to the King's enemies, wherever, within the British territory or without, is a treasonable offence. And it is, at the end of 1945, the Commonwealth, British common law still was operative within the state courts. And so in order to try Cousins for this crime of treason that had been taking place outside Australia, it had to be run through the state courts, and it was the New South Wales court that would do this, because of course this was all taking place in Sydney. And there was essentially, and it is documented, the writing is there, in fact I've written quite a bit about this in my book, because it seemed to me so extraordinary, that there was a disagreement between the federal Attorney General, who said, we will run the case, we will provide the QCs, we'll pay for it, but you must offer it for us in the New South Wales Supreme Court. And Weigel, in the end, said, we've had the feds. I mean, this is essentially what he said, that we will not have federal interference in the orderly running of the state courts. And even though federal Attorney General and the Labor Party lent on them to do this, they simply no-billed Cousins and withdrew. And this is the very last thing for me to say. It has a curious epilogue too, because there was one other treason trial that was to have taken place here in Sydney, also by a broadcaster, but by a civilian, Mr. John Hollands. When this fell through because of the feds, the federal Attorney General then asked the British Attorney General if they would try Holland in Britain, because he said, we cannot possibly go through another one of these schmozzles where we sink the money in, we provide the QCs, and then the states stand on their dignity and no bill. So in fact, he was tried in Bow Street in London. He was found guilty as a traitor, but by then the heat had gone out of the whole issue. People were over the war, wanting to get on with post-war reconstruction. So he got for doing, in fact, much more than Charles Cousins ever did. He got a one-year good behaviour bond and sort of faded away. So that's the end of my story. What I also think is very interesting about this is that at the time when it was taking place, there was enormous ferment about it. The newspapers are absolutely full of this trial, and the questions about Japanese witnesses and the questions about Australian servicemen and the appalling treatment of POWs. But I guess it's a sign of the optimism of people, that people simply very quickly wanted to put this behind them and go on with post-war reconstruction and essentially forget about it. Charles Cousins, of course, does not forget about it. No build. After a short time, he went back to 2GB, but it wasn't very successful. And very briefly, he had a period when he was an announcer on television, in the new medium of television that came, of course, in the early 50s. But he really that was not successful either. And I would say by then he was, you know, had been so beaten by this terrible experience. In fact, he died when he was 60, as a relatively, as I say, more and more, it's a very young age. So there I stop, and I'd be interested to hear what you have to say. Many of you may remember these events, indeed. So, and that's always interesting too.
The war is on us. So we come to questions and discussion. Janet Rumney's got some copies of Treason on the Airways, which is outside, and I'm sure Dr. Keane will be happy to author to sign any copies. Just we'll take questions, of course, on broadly on the topic, but can I just ask you to elaborate slightly beyond the topic, but not
sure.
Much. There wasn't much feeling for Japan within Australia, was there? I mean, there were allegations later on, mainly by the left, that certain Australians were sympathetic to the Japanese. But once the Pacific War broke out, that wasn't true, was it? It wasn't true of Cousins, obviously, because whatever he did and whatever he shouldn't have done, had he not been there, he wouldn't be advocating for Japan. So just what was the feeling towards Japan within Australia during this period? Just come back here.
Sure.
Talk to the end of the room.
Well, I think there was, and Neville Maney, I know, who's been here to talk to you, there was enormous distrust of Japan. Though there certainly were economic relationships. I mean, Beltrees, the whites of Beltrees, export and fine wool growers exported to Japan and had very amicable relationships with Japanese wool classes, and in fact had young Japanese chaps as jackaroo. So there certainly are those connections. But I think there was a slight paranoia that there was this belief that there was this secret group in Australia who were manoeuvring if Japan had won the war to take over. And some people argue that Cousins would have been the president or something. But I looked at all that stuff quite carefully, because I'd hope, I mean, that's a great story if you could find it in the archives. But as far as I can see, it simply is not there. So there is a sense of, a sense that Japan, in a way, is a vacuum for many people. And I know that the ABC used to teach Japanese language on the ABC in the early 30s. And that I traced too, because I thought, well, that's very interesting, that there could be a whole strand of Australians keen to learn Japanese. But in fact, the lessons were cut off, not, as I found in the ABC records, not because people the government said don't do it, but simply there was absolutely no interest. And so in the end, there was one person in Narrabri attempting to learn Japanese on the ABC, or whatever. I would say Narrabri because my husband's from there. But, you know, that too, it wasn't that there was some great conspiracy about Japan. And now we know, of course, that, what's his name, argues that certainly the people that I've been researching were fearful that the Japanese were going to invade. Though we know there's a sort of new revisionism that says that probably wasn't going to happen either. It was rather that Kirby was, you know, wanting to galvanise people. Now, I don't know if that answers
your
question.
Yep. It does. Now, Lindsay?
Hello. Under the Australian Crimes Act, treason, I think, still carries, or did until very recently, the death penalty. if Cousins had been convicted in New South Wales, would that have required an automatic death penalty to be imposed? And if so, is that something that the authorities were worried about in advance?
Look, I don't think...
Second, the question is, if Cousins had been convicted in New South Wales, would a death penalty have applied?
It would have. It would have, and there's lots of discussion of that in the briefs prepared by the council, giving advice, Dovey, Windia and Barwick, giving advice to the state. And in fact, I found in the Victoria Barracks, archives in the Victoria Barracks that are in the National Library, that the military were very keen that he was made an example of, and that one of the reasons that they wished the trial to proceed quickly, as it did, was that wanted it to proceed in a civilian court, because the military court he couldn't have been executed through a court martial, because the documents that they had were not still valid after 3 years, I think, whereas in the civilian court that didn't apply. And so I don't think there was any, certainly not in the things that I read, any sense that people were attempting to protect him. People who wanted to prosecute him wanted to bring the whole law. But that would have been, that would have been quite extraordinary, actually.
Now, APEC from Fox Alanostas here said the camera's down the back, so there's no need to stand up, because you might get in the road of the camera shop. Peter Coleman.
Following on Gerard Henderson's question, two groups... compromising Australia's first people in Sydney or Australia.
Yes.
And I think in Perth. They, in any way, hook in with this movement,
hang on,
these ideas. And secondly, weren't there a couple of fundamental groups in Japan?
There were.
Australians in them are recommending friendship between the two countries.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a question about the Australia First movement in Australia under Inky Stevenson. Does that link in with the Cousins group, and what about some groups in Japan who are interested?
There certainly were. You know more about Australia First probably than I do, but they don't. That connection is not there. But the group that were in Japan, and they were in Shanghai too, that were actually on the Australian Wanted Renegades list, they link in with Holland, the second chap who was tried and then found guilty in London. But they seem to me, unlike Cousins, that those people were very marginal, who'd set up these sort of small Nazi cells, mostly being funded, because those sorts of things got incredibly good funding from Berlin. And you're absolutely right, as you would of course be, there's documentation about mounting a trial against some of them. There was a woman whose stuff I've read carefully who seemed to me actually wacko, to be honest, and who eventually was allowed to come back to Perth and was not prosecuted. But so they are of a different order, you know, sort of marginal people who are always sort of gathering at the periphery of war and conflict, and mostly with either their own crazy ideology or for money.
So,
there's a question
here. Yeah.
Well,
hang on,
here.
Just a quick.
I'm sorry, I'll get into serious trouble because this is not a question. I was a personal friend of Charles Cousins.
Oh, were you?
No, not that there's any significance about that, but because when he came back after the war, Fairfax invited him to read the news on Channel 7.
Yes.
In fact, he was, I think, our first newsreader.
Oh, that's
the point about I make is all these sinister remarks about Australia First. He was an extraordinary man. He was the most sensitive person, artistic, as you say. And one of his problems reading the news was that he would have a sad story and he would cry on camera. And this, you know, you can imagine a sensitive man flung into the environment in Tokyo.
Yes.
The Japanese didn't practice the Geneva Convention.
Yeah,
they had very nasty ways of making him speak. And I can tell you stories about a child which came out through my months of working with him. That will make a guess down there. But there was nothing really sinister.
He was
just an exceptionally sensitive man in a very unfortunate environment.
James, did you hear that? Did you pick that up?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm really interested to hear that, actually. And in fact, I have a theory, reinforces, so one's always glad to hear information that reinforces one's own ideas. But it does seem to me, Kent Hughes wrote at the time of the collapse of Singapore, that a lot of the men in his battalion, he said, were half deranged, is the word he uses, because of the shock of this incredible defeat by people who was never believed that the British and the Australian Army would be defeated so quickly. And the people were extraordinarily discombobulated, really. And in fact, he talks about the first time, the first unit that was sent to Burma. He said a lot of these, it's a story that really makes me weep even to think of, it makes a goosebump stand up. He said a lot of those men didn't think they were going to Burma. They really thought they were going to be repatriated and come back to Australia because it was so difficult to manage this. And I think Cousins fits into that too, because he truly thought when he went to Japan that he would speak to the Japanese and tell them about what was going on in the POW camps. And of course that's silly. He also was at this rather weak professional. He was a professional, and there's no doubt he loved doing radio. So there's no question that he did a great job in Japan. But I would love you ought to write these things down. Actually.
I wish I could remember all, the stories he told me are most exciting.
Knew him, and you say he was compassionate. Would you also say he was naive?
Oh, I would think so. Yeah. He was an artist, more or less. Obviously, a professional at the top. Great radio announcer in Sydney 2GB before the Japanese realised how important he was.
Yes.
But he
believed Mary Baker Eddy. He was always quoting Mary Baker Eddy as a source for all sorts of information.
Maybe she was, but who was she? Mary Baker Eddy, who was Mary?
But he went to America to defend the American.
Yeah, she's a Christian Scientist. She's the mother of Christian Science.
She's the
father
of Christian Science.
Yes. Yeah. So.
Well, I'm not a Christian scientist. I'm a secular scientist. So there's a question there. We've got to be quick. Okay, then, Ellen. Yes, in the yellow chapter. Yep.
Was Cousins cashiered and deprived of veterans' benefits?
He was. So when he was no-billed, this is in the documents too, the same group at Victoria Barracks went to Canberra and gathered again with the senior council, Domi Windia and Barwick, and they worked out what the military could have against him. He was cashiered, humiliated, and got no veterans benefits, no POW benefits, no nothing. But we know it is, it's quite, and I think the humiliation was the, well, obviously the cash matters, but the humiliation was important, actually. So
the question there, yeah.
I'd like to speak of somebody else, if I may.
Yes.
And I think it's connected. My father was a German prisoner before.
I was, yeah.
And I might say that those men would speak very little of his experiences there, and they were kept in a state of starvation.
Yes.
He was in camp with Douglas Channel, who was a very well-known, celebrated announcer, ABC announcer before the war. He was taken away by the Gestapo on a number of occasions.
Yep.
Because Goebbels wanted him to broadcast propaganda.
Yeah. Yep.
And all my father could say was the bastards, because he'd come back several weeks later, having persisted once again. So, there were a number of cases, but I don't think Bob would ever talk. I don't know. He would have told his family, but I don't even know if they'd be seeing you, because that's the way they were.
I think we should repeat that. The suggestion was that the question is. Father was a prisoner of war in Germany who had been tortured and who had a very low regard for people like Cousins, because that's not how he had performed in Germany in a not dissimilar situation.
And this, I'll say something which is a response to what you've said and which may annoy some people here, but I think just to say what you're saying, when I started working on this material, it would be possible to write what I call in my head, though I have great admiration for the institution, a sort of the RSL story, which would be simply to tell this everything in a very heroic way, and to tell the story so that always the Japanese are horrible and bash people, and the Japanese certainly did bash people. But I actually I couldn't do that anyway, because I'm a properly trained historian. But it seems to me, one with these stories that we are very familiar with, to tell a nuanced story that doesn't suggest that there is this saintly man who was bashed every time and Australians are, or blah, 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 it seems to me to go back and rework some of these things, which are stories we know very well, just as it seems to be very important, and you ought to write about your father.
Well, What I'm trying to say is that they were very modest men when they came back, and they hated the RSL. They didn't want to go anywhere. People were bragging.
Okay, Alan Gill.
My father, who was a clerk in a law firm, had some involvement in the apprehension of William Joyce, the Lord Forbore.
Yes.
And he gave him a signed autograph with a flourish, which I still have. Did you do any research into him?
Well, I read, there's a lot of work on Lord Forbore. There are lots and lots of really excellent books. Virtually all of them I've read. And there's a huge archive of his material in the Public Record Office in London, which is available on the net. And yeah, I did. And he seems to me an unambiguous figure, except that, remember, he was not British, even though he was executed as a British traitor. But the argument that was made in his case was that he had pretended to be British, and therefore he had expected the British flag to cover him, even though legally he was not British. So there's now an interesting reworking of all of that too. Yeah.
He was not British because he was Irish.
Well, he had an American passport and an Irish passport, and in fact he'd taken German nationality before the war. So all of that was rather quite complicated.
Sure.
Yes.
The cousins and Tokyo Roseland sounded like the Stockholm Syndrome.
I don't think so, because Tokyo Rose, Eva Toguri, very strenuously always denied that she had any time for the emperor or for the Japs. She called them Nips and Japs in the things that she wrote putting together her application to get her passport renewed. So I don't think it's quite like that. Though obviously that works where you come to identify with your jailers, but I don't think it works quite for either of them. And not for Amory either, because he loved them. He was, he liked them even before he began. He certainly liked the money.
So we came to the end. So we go 1, 2, 3. Yep. Down it. Yep.
As part of your research, did you come across any from the Allied side who had been broadcasting the Allied bases into Germany or Japan?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, I did. And in fact, it's like a huge network of shortwave going across Europe and across the Pacific too. And in fact, there's a very famous one that Sefton Delma ran, was part of his black propaganda unit in the Second World War, that would go to North Africa and talk to prisoners, and Millicent somebody was the announcer, and would get prisoners to say who they were. And in fact, a number of Australians appeared on that, and they would say, "I'm Joe Blome from Sydney, my mum is Edith, and I send her a message." And then that would similarly then meant people were listening to their program. They would be saying, "Yeah, that's right." They would be saying, "I'm Joe Blow from Berlin, and my mum is Hilda," and that's where I was captured.
Fred.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than the Stockholm syndrome, is it a bit like the movie The Bridge on the River Kwai, where professionalism took over and pride in the product?
Yeah, I think
and
so.
He couldn't help himself. Yeah. Almost that he had to do a good job like that stupid colonel or whatever he was.
Yes. No, I think there is an element of that, actually. Yeah. And that doesn't surprise me as somebody who really likes my work, but who herself enjoys her work. That, I don't know, if I was taken away by the Nazis and then they said, "Here's an archive and I want you to write the best history of, I don't know, Jews in Narrabri," I would just be beavering away. And so there is an element of that, actually. Really? Yeah.
Final question, Stuart, and then Stuart. During the 1930s, did Amory have any relationship with Mosley and the British Union of Fascists?
No, he didn't, curiously, because he spent most of that time he was in France. And no, he didn't at all. In fact, I've tracked that very carefully. And No, whereas you would imagine that he did. Same class and same interests, essentially. So, no, he was in France, hanging out with... trying to make movies, actually. He was an aspiring movie maker. And trying to make... hanging out with the Cagoule, you know, the right, extreme right-wing people in the south of France.
We've got a few more minutes. Anne?
What is the sort of chronological history of this use of radio as propaganda, because it obviously is a new thing.
Yes.
Radio, the 30s and everything, yes. It's just taking off. Yes. Who started thinking up these wonderfully clever uses of radio for propaganda? Was it the Germans, the Japanese? I mean, where does it all fit together? Seriously.
Well, introduce it to the Vatican.
Well, apart from all of that, you know, what's the developmental threat?
It's the Germans, particularly, and they do it in... It starts off making contact with the Volksdeutsch, you know, with German language programs back into Poland and all of those places. And then it expands enormously, and everybody does it. So the British and the Germans and the Italians do it. And then the Japanese, really, they have this big study. They send two or three people from Broadcast House through the Pacific and through the US, talking to Japanese communities in the US, and then looking at how successful the BBC was. And the Japanese in the US said, we would love to have Japanese language programs from you, but they are so horrendous and they're so boring, and the music is this, you know, traditional stringed instruments from Kyoto, whereas what people want to listen to is jazz. I mean, new music is the thing. And so they went home and totally retooled. And then, first of all, attempted to use journalists who were... in Japan at the time to get involved, and they had a couple of people who did.
What years would this be?
This is the early 30s, starting about 33, and then building up. And then eventually, once the war had happened, they combed the pens and the POW camps looking for people with any writing or particularly radio or performance experience, and they picked them up and took them to Japan.
Second last question here.
Yes. Did you form a view as to whether these broadcasts were in any way effective in lowering morale?
No. Over and over, the information is suggested that they don't. People listen for the music, and no, they don't. And I think that's probably why, after the Second World War, propaganda just sort of kind of goes off the boil, really. Because it's the new medium, the new mass medium, isn't it? For everybody to have a radio and to listen. But then when it's not effective, then it...
Very brief question.
Yes, Professor Keith, you said that the Allied soldiers very much liked to listen to these programs. Were they not forbidden to do that?
No.
The question is, were the Allied soldiers prohibited from listening?
But what the Americans do very fast is they set up the Stars and Stripes radio. So by the end of the war, there is the competing shortwave. It's coming from... Stars and Stripes, which plays the same music as Zero Hour, but has the same patter, but is putting a patriotic message from the Americans. So.
Final question. This book, there's a huge amount of work in this book.
How
long did it take you to write, and what's next?
Well, it took me about 3 years, I guess, actually. But I know some of this material pretty well. And I'm actually working on, you won't believe it, the American prisoners in the Korean War. I'm obsessed with the Korean War. I'm thinking about it. I'm watching Korean War movies. Anyone who says anything about Korea, I'm listening. It's like having a secret life.
You listen to Wilfred Burchard?
Yeah, I am. I'm sure, of course. I'm busily reading Wilfred Burchard stuff, and of course there will be a chapter, as will Wintringham.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.